All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chris Peterson, Massimertani, Italy. A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Chapter 17. A Costly Recapture. As the speaker ceased, he turned to leave the apartment by the door where I was standing, but I needed to wait no longer. I had heard enough to fill my soul with dread, and stealing quietly away, I returned to the courtyard by the way I had come. My plan of action was formed upon the instant, and crossing the square and the bordering avenue upon the opposite side, I soon stood within the courtyard of Calhages. The brilliantly lighted apartments of the first floor told me where to first seek, and advancing to the windows, I peered within. I soon discovered that my approach was not to be the easy thing I had hoped for, but the rear rooms bordering the court were filled with warriors and women. I then glanced up at the stories above, discovering that the third was apparently unlighted, and so decided to make my entrance to the building from that point. It was the work of but a moment for me to reach the windows above, and soon I had drawn myself within the sheltering shadows of the unlighted third floor. Fortunately, the room I had selected was untenanted, and creeping noises led to the corridor beyond. I discovered a light in the apartments ahead of me. Reaching what appeared to be a doorway, I discovered that it was but an opening upon an immense inner chamber, which towered from the first floor, two stories below me, to the dome-like roof of the building, high above my head. The floor of this great circular hall was thronged with chieftains, warriors, and women, and at one end was a great raised platform upon which squatted the most hideous beast I had ever put my eyes upon. He had all the cold, hard, cruel, terrible features of the green warriors, but accentuated and debased by the animal passions to which he had given himself over for many years. There was not a mark of dignity or pride upon his bestial countenance, while his enormous bulk spread itself out upon the platform where he squatted like some huge devilfish, his six limbs accentuating the similarity in a horrible and startling manner. But the sight that froze me with apprehension was that of Deja Horus and Sola standing there before him, and the fiendish leer of him as he let his great protruding eyes gloat upon the lines of her beautiful figure. She was speaking, but I could not hear what she said, nor could I make out the low grumbling of his reply. She stood there, erect before him, her head held high, and even at the distance I was from them, I could read the scorn and disgust upon her face as she let her haughty glance was indeed the proud daughter of a thousand jeddaks. Every inch of her dear, precious little body, so small, so frail beside the towering warriors around her, but even her majesty dwarfing them into insignificance, she is the mightiest figure among them, and I verily believe that they felt it. Presently, Talhaeus made a sign that the chamber should be cleared and the prisoners be left alone before her. Slowly, the chieftains, the warriors, and the women melted away into the shadows of the surrounding chambers, and Deja, Horus, and Sola stood alone before the Jeddak of the Tharks. One chieftain alone and hesitated before departing. I saw him standing in the shadows of a mighty column, his fingers nervously toying with the hilt of his greatsword, and his cruel eyes bent in implacable hatred upon Talhaeus. It was Tars Tarkas, and I could read his thoughts as they were an open book for the undisguised loathing upon his face. He was thinking of that other woman who, 40 years ago, had stood before this beast, and could I have spoken a word into his ear at that moment, the reign of Talhaeus would have been over. But finally, he also strode from the room, not knowing that he left his own daughter at the mercy of the creature he most loathed. Talhaeus arose, and I, half fearing, half anticipating his intentions, hurried to the winding runway which led to the floors below. No one was near to intercept me, and I reached the main floor of the chamber unobserved, taking my station in the shadow of the same column that Tars Tarkas had just deserted. As I reached the floor, Talhaeus was speaking. "Princess of Helium, I might wring a mighty ransom from your people would I but return you to them unharmed, but 1,000 times rather would I watch that beautiful face writhe in the agony of torture. It shall be long drawn out, that I promise you. 10 days of pleasure were all too short to show the love I harbor for your race. The terrors of your death shall haunt the slumbers of the red men through all the ages to come. They will shudder in the shadows of the night as their fathers tell them of the awful vengeance of the green men, of the power and might and hate and cruelty of Talhaeus. But before the torture, you shall be mine for one short hour, and word of that too shall go forth to Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium, your grandfather, that he may grovel upon the ground in the agony of his sorrow. Tomorrow the torture will commence. Tonight, thou art Talhaeus. Come." He sprang down from the platform and grasped her roughly by the arm, but scarcely than I leaped between them. My short sword, sharp and gleaming, was in my right hand. I could have plunged it into his putrid heart before he realized that I was upon him. But as I raised my arm to strike, I thaumatized Tarkus, and with all my rage, with all my hatred, I could not rob him of that sweet moment for which he had lived in hope all these long weary years. And so, instead, I swung my good right fist full upon the point of his jaw. Without a sound, slipped he to the floor as one dead. In that same deathly silence, I grasped Deja Doris by the hand, and motioning Sola to follow me, we sped noiselessly from the chamber to the floors above. Unseen, we reached a rear window, and with the straps and leather of my trappings, I lowered first Sola and then Deja Doris to the ground below. Dropping lightly after them, I drew them rapidly around the court in the shadows of the buildings, and thus we returned over the same course I had so recently followed from the distant boundary of the city. We finally came upon my thoughts in the courtyard where I had left them, and placing the trappings upon them, we hastened through the building to the avenue beyond, mounting Sola upon one beast and Deja Doris behind me upon the other. We rode from the city of Tharp through the hills to the south. Instead of circling back around the city to the northwest and toward the nearest waterway which lay so short a distance from us, we turned to the northeast and struck out upon the mossy waste across which, for 200 dangerous and weary miles, lay another main artery leading to Helium. No word was spoken until we had left the city far behind, but I could hear the quiet sobbing of Deja Doris as she clung to me with her dear head resting against my shoulder. If we make it, my chieftain, the debt of Helium will be a mighty one, greater than she can ever pay you. And should we not make it, she continued, the debt is no less, though Helium will never know, for you have saved the last one of our line from worse than death. I did not answer, but instead reached to my side and pressed the little fingers of her I loved where they clung to me for support. And then, in unbroken silence, we sped over the yellow moonlit moss, each of us occupied with his own thoughts. For my part, I could not be other than joyful had I tried. But Deja Doris's warm body pressed close to mine, and with all our unpassed danger, my heart was singing as gaily as though we were already entering the gates of Helium. Our earlier plans had been so sadly upset that we now found ourselves without food or drink, and I alone was armed. We therefore urged our beast to a speed that must tell on them sorely before we could hope to sight the ending of the first stage of our journey. We rode all night and all the following we lay down upon the moss and slept for some 5 or 6 hours, taking up the journey once more before daylight. All the following day we rode, and when late in the afternoon we had sighted no distant trees, the mark of the great waterways throughout all Barsoom, the terrible truth flashed upon us. We were lost. Evidently, we had circled, but which way was difficult to say, nor did it seem possible with the sun to guide us by day and the moons and stars by night. At any rate, no waterway was in sight, and the entire party was almost ready to drop from hunger, thirst, and fatigue. Far ahead of us, and a trifle to the right, we could distinguish the outlines of low mountains. These we decided to attempt to reach in the hope that from some ridge we might discern the missing waterway. Night fell upon us before we reached our goal, and almost fainting from weariness and weakness, we lay down and slept. I was awakened early in the morning by some huge body pressing close to mine, and opening my eyes with a start, I beheld my blessed old Woola snuggling close to me. The faithful brute had followed us across that trackless waste to share our fate, whatever it might be. Putting my arms about his neck, I pressed my cheek close to his. Nor am I ashamed that I did it, nor of the tears that came to my eyes as I thought of his love for me. Shortly after this, Deja, Thoris, and Sola awakened, and it was decided that we push on at once in an effort to gain the hills. We had scarcely gone a mile when I noticed that my throat was commencing to stumble and stagger in a most pitiful manner. Although we had not attempted to force them out of a walk since about noon of the preceding day, suddenly he lurched wildly to one side and pitched violently to the ground. Deja, Thoris, and I were thrown clear of him and fell upon the soft moss with scarcely a jar. But the poor beast was in pitiable condition, not even being able to rise, although relieved of our weight. Sola told me the coolness of the night when it fell, together with the rest, would doubtless revive him, and so I decided not to kill him, as was my first intention, as I had thought it cruel to leave him alone there to die of hunger and thirst. Relieving him of his trappings, which I flung down beside him, we left the poor fellow to his fate and pushed on with one boat as best we could. Sola and I walked, making Deja Thoris ride, much against her will. In this way, we had progressed to within about a mile of the hills we were endeavoring to reach, when Deja Thoris, from her point of vantage upon the boat, cried out that she saw a great party of mounted men filing down from a pass in the hills several miles away. Sola and I both looked in the direction she indicated, and there, plainly discernible, were several hundred mounted warriors. They seem to be heading in a southwesterly direction, which would take them away from us. They doubtless were Thark warriors who had been sent out to capture us, and we breathed a great sigh of relief that they were traveling in the opposite direction. Quickly lifting Deja Thoris from the folk, I commanded the animal to lie down, and we three did the same, presenting as small an object as possible for fear of attracting the attention of the warriors toward us. We could see them as they filed out of the past just for an instant before they were lost to view behind a friendly ridge, to us a most providential ridge, since had they been in view for any great length of time, they scarcely could have failed to discover us. As what proved to be the last warrior came into view from the pass, he halted and, to our consternation, threw his small but powerful field glass to his eye and scanned the sea bottom in all directions. Evidently, he was a chieftain, for in certain marching formations among the green men, a chieftain brings up the extreme rear of the column. As his glass swung toward us, our hearts stopped in our breasts, and I could feel the cold sweat start from every pore of my body. Presently, it swung full upon us and stopped. The tension on our nerves was near the breaking point, and I doubt if any of us breathed for the first few moments he held us covered by his glass. And then he lowered it, and we could see him shout a command to the warriors who had passed from our sight beyond the ridge. He did not wait for them to join him. However, instead, he wheeled his throat and came tearing madly in our direction. There was but one slight chance, and that we must take quickly. Raising my strange Martian rifle to my shoulder, I sighted and touched the button which controlled the trigger. There was a sharp explosion as the missile reached its goal, and the charging chieftain pitched backward from his flying mount. Springing to my feet, I urged the boat to rise and directed Sola to take Deja Thoris with her upon him and make a mighty effort to reach the hills before the green warriors were upon us. I knew that in the ravines and gullies they might find a temporary hiding place, and even though they died there of hunger and thirst, it would be better so than that they fell into the hands of the Tharks. Forcing my two revolvers upon them as a slight means of protection and as a last resort, as an escape for themselves from the horrid death which recapture would surely mean, I lifted Deja Thoris in my arms and placed her upon the boat behind Sola, who had already mounted at my command. "Behind there, Princess," I whispered. "We may meet in Helium yet. I have escaped from worse plights than this," and I tried to smile as I lied. "What?" she cried. "Are you not coming with us?" "How may I, Deja Thoris? Someone must hold these fellows off for a while, and I can better escape them alone than could the three of us together." She sprang quickly from dear arms around my neck turned to Sola, saying with quiet dignity, "Fly, Sola. Deja Flores remains to die with a man she loves." Those words are engraved upon my heart. Oh, gladly I would give up my life a thousand times could I only hear them once again. But I could not then give even a second to the rapture of her sweet embrace. And pressing my lips to hers for the first time, I picked her up bodily and tossed her to her seat behind Sola again, commanding the latter in peremptory tones to hold her there by force, and then slapping the foot upon the flank, I saw them borne away, Deja Flores struggling to the last to free herself from Sola's grasp. Turning, I beheld the green warriors mounting the ridge and looking for their chieftain. In a moment, they saw him, and then me. But scarcely had they discovered me than I commenced firing, laying flat upon my belly in the moss. I had an even 100 rounds in the magazine of my rifle, and another 100 in the belt at my back, and I kept up a continuous stream of fire until I saw all of the warriors who had been first to return from behind the ridge, either dead or scurrying to cover. My respite was short-lived, however, for soon the entire party, numbering some thousand men, came charging into view, racing madly toward me. I fired until my rifle was empty and they were almost upon me, and then a glance showing me that Deja Flores and Sola had disappeared among the hills, I sprang up, throwing down my useless gun, and started away in the direction opposite to that taken by Sola and her charge. If ever Martians had an exhibition of jumping, it was granted those astonished warriors on that day long years ago. But while it led them away from Deja Flores, it did not distract their attention from endeavoring to capture me. They raced wildly after me until finally my foot struck a projecting piece of quartz, and down I went sprawling upon the moss. As I looked up, they were upon me. And although I drew my long sword in an attempt to sell my life as dearly as possible, it was soon over. I reeled beneath their blows, which fell upon me in perfect torrents. My head swam, all was black, and I went down